don't read too much into that bumper. I just want to make sure we're clear on that. Referencing back to the last hour when somebody said that to be Masonic was to be at least a fellow traveler with Luciferians. That's what gives us the bumper there. And I will argue back, that is not the story of the secret temple. Peter Lavenda is our guest. We're going to be talking about Freemasonry. We'll be talking about secret societies, about the foundations of this country, both as it was explored as a continent, and then later on in the form of its government and its architecture. We'll be talking about Freemasonry as we understand it, as we think it can be actually proven. What are the connections, and what aren't connections that can really be verified? We'll talk about that with Peter Lavenda after we clear up a couple of issues from the open line segment next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Peter Lavenda, you know I love your work, and this is no exception. The Secret Temple, as I said last hour, I won't be loaning out this book anytime soon. In fact, I'm going to go back and read it one more time before all of these major works come out of fiction and nonfiction in the next couple of months. It's a pleasure to talk with you again.
Oh, it's my pleasure indeed. Thank you very much.
All right. Now, last hour, open lines, somebody brought up the Simon of the Necronomicon fame and Peter Lavenda. And, of course, you know all over the Internet, your name is connected to this famous book that's been out now for about 30-plus years or so and is still in paperback. What is your position these days on you as Simon of the Necronomicon?
Well, if someone asked me this just a little while ago again, and I told them it was a canard, of course I was involved with the book. There's, you know, no mystery about that. But to conflate me with Simon is probably kind of a mistake. I was involved, of course, in the very early days when the book was around. My role in that's pretty well known. There's been interviews with me on that subject. But other than that, I guess there's not much more to talk about.
Okay. I enjoyed my interview with Simon that night, and I had found some Peter Lavenda-like connections with him. So I'm glad to be able to address that and
sure.
To say, should you talk with Simon again, tell Simon I said hi, okay?
I sure will.
Almost a million copies of that book or something like that the last time I heard.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's an exaggeration or not, but it's close to a million sold, isn't it?
I believe that's about right. I think it's about a million. And it's been in paperback, I think, since 1980 or the early 1980s anyway.
So let's talk about the Masonic material here in the Secret Temple. And I think that people who are Masons, who like our last caller before the top of the hour, I don't think they have anything to fear from this conversation. Or for that matter, I don't think Mormons have anything to fear either. That was one of our first callers last hour with open lines, was a concern about that. But you address all of these things, secret societies, both those that we know of and those that we don't think of as secret societies in this book. And I think you do it really fairly, and it seems to me accurately. Talk about the research that you put into the Secret Temple before we go any further.
Okay. Basically, I have been researching religion, politics, and the esoteric groups for many years. My book, Sinister Forces, which I've been interviewed, I think, with George on, is testament to that. It's three volumes where I go into a lot of detail about government, churches, extreme political groups, extreme religious groups, and always Freemasons come up in this conversation. I mean, for many people, Masonry is the ultimate secret society. And during the 1930s in Germany, Freemasonry became really an object of attention by the Nazis, who felt that this was a sinister organization, and they banned it. They considered it part of this worldwide global conspiracy. So there's been a lot of stuff out there on Freemasonry, and I thought to myself, well, we should really take a look at it, because the books written by Freemasons can be very misleading, as well as the books written by non-Freemasons who have an agenda or an axe to grind. So I did a lot of research, and I went back as far as I could I started researching the very earliest Masonic documents, which go back to the 14th century. This is not, you know, recent stuff. This is going back quite far, almost to the time of the Knights Templar. So in backtracking from there and up to the present time, trying to keep track of all the various Masonic groups or groups calling themselves Freemasons, and even, of course, the Illuminati and all of this, which is going to become a big issue in the next couple of weeks with the release of Dan Brown's book, Dan Brown's movie, rather,
right.
Angels and Demons. So people are going to be talking about Illuminati and the Freemasons and the Templars and everything again. And I thought it might be a good idea to draw some lines and say, okay, here's where the Freemasons stand, and here's where the Templars are, and here's where the Illuminati are.
Yep. And I think you did it really well. I just want to say again, very, really readable and a real pleasure to see somebody who's done the heavy lifting of history to look for the original documents, which I maintain all the time on the show. They're out there somewhere. They may be in shoeboxes somewhere in somebody's closet, but there are a lot more of the original source material than I think people really bother with. And I think that this is where the most interesting work is going back and looking at what was done. What are the proto pieces that we can look at, we can hold, we can translate, as opposed to the fifth or sixth translation of something that somebody read about on an internet website.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the point I was trying to make in Unholy Alliance when I wrote about the Nazis and the occult. There's just so much speculation about that, so much fanciful work that's been done, and yet the real documents were sitting in the National Archives all this time. You know,
right?
They were just there. All anyone had to do was go there and read them, and the truth was a lot stranger than the fiction. And the same thing, I think, is true with the Freemasons.
Well, and I think that it does – that weaves back into this discussion at some point later on, because we can talk about Henry Ford and some of the other things that come in toward the end of your book, which I think are worthy of bringing back up again. But let's just – for people – I mean, it's hard to imagine that there are many people out there that are uninitiated, if you'll pardon the pun, on the discussion of Masonry. But define generally what we're talking about and give a description of Masonic versus Freemasonry, just so we can sort of define our terms up front.
Okay, sure. What we're talking about Freemasonry, meaning in the context of this discussion, it's a secret society. According to the traditional histories of Freemasonry, the society began in the year 1717 in the United Kingdom in London with the formation of the United Grand Lodge. Freemasonry assigns its beginning to that period, which is very deceptive, actually, from my point of view, since there's obviously many people have been initiated into this society long before 1717. But Masons, of course, are people who are involved in bricklaying, they're involved in stonework, they're involved in building buildings. A Freemason was a term that came into use during the feudal period, during the time when the castles were being built. And, you know, a lord owned his castle, he owned the lands around it, and everyone who lived there worked for him. A Freemason, however, was a specialized worker. He was a skilled craftsman who could travel freely between one lord's estate and another lord's estate, between one part of the country to another. They were free. They were not bound to one parcel of land. So they didn't just sit there in one place and build buildings in one location, obviously. So the term Freemason came about from there. It was a guild. It was a society of people who passed on secrets of building, of geometry, of measurement. They kept these secrets very close to the chest, and they farmed their work out to various people who hired them to build the cathedrals, the great Gothic cathedrals of France, but public buildings of any kind. It could be castles, it could be warehouses, it could be public buildings, palaces. So these Freemasons, their skills were very much in demand. They knew how to build a building so that it wouldn't fall down, quite frankly. And then past that, they learned the secrets of what I call in my book sacred geometry.
Right.
Putting in stone philosophical ideas and religious concepts in the actual layouts of their buildings. So Freemasonry is a lot more than just building the building. It's a society of people who had secrets. In the old days, it was the secrets of geometry. It was the secrets of measurement. of orientation to the stars and to the rising sun and the solstices and equinoxes. So it was a cosmological system that they embodied in their own work, which I found fascinating.
I think it is fascinating, and I think it's also fair to say, as just similarly as a student of human nature, that it only makes sense that they kept those secrets because out of those secrets came their living. And if you gave those secrets away, you gave away part of your income.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, it was in their blueprint, it's in their DNA to keep secrets. Now, the argument over time is that that secret-keeping disposition changes when we move from a mason that's actually laying bricks and using a trowel to the Masons that are only Masonic in name. So explain that for the Masonic groups that develop that never once lay a brick in their life.
Sure. The term for the ones who actually lay the bricks, they're called operative Masons. They actually operate as Masons. The Masons who never laid a brick in their lives but who are Freemasons are called speculative Masons. And that's called speculative Freemasonry. And what that is they've taken the essential philosophy behind the sacred geometry of the operative, of the actual Masons, and have now reinterpreted this in a spiritual, in a ritualistic sense. And that's the idea you get when you first study Freemasonry. I think it's much deeper than that. But for the sake of the discussion in the beginning, let's just say that, you know, the Masons who were laying bricks had their secrets, and their secrets were not only how to build a building, but they embodied certain other secrets as well, the orientation of the buildings. The cubit, the actual unit of measurement itself, was something that was jealously guarded from one Mason to another. It was passed on from father to son. You know, the actual unit of measurement would be engraved on an iron rod or an iron stick, a ruler, and this cubit would be passed on as an inheritance to the children of the Mason. So there were secrets, and there were things that they jealously guarded. But at one point, at some point in this whole development of architecture and masonry, suddenly there was a philosophical religious conflict that developed. I believe, and a lot of Freemasons will think that I'm being very naive or nuts on this, but I do believe there was a connection to the Knights Templar. I believe that when the Templars were suppressed, it's quite possible that some of these ideas became embodied, the Templar ideas became resurrected in the Masonic society. And I give some evidence for this in the Secret Temple as to why I believe this is so, although I'm very well aware of the fact that most Freemasons say there's no connection whatsoever, but I do see one, and that is the Templars themselves financed, in many cases, the building of these Gothic cathedrals in France. They were the employers of the Masons. So I believe there was some kind of communication between the two.
And I want to explore that a little further on in the conversation. I think that that's an interesting pivotal time in the history of Freemasonry. But I think that let's go back to the idea of the measurement and the tools and stuff, because we see, you know, in the typical Masonic logos, that's what we see are the tools of a Mason. We see the compass, you see the right angle, and you see the letter G. And there's a lot of speculation about what that G stands for. In your research, have you come up with a definitive explanation of the G that exists inside the symbol of Masonry?
Well, there's controversy even among Masons themselves, but the short answer is the G stands for God. But if you look a little deeper, they say the G really stands for geometer. God as the great geometer, as the great measurer, as the great architect of the universe. And in fact, God is referred to as the great architect of the universe. That's the title by which God is referred to in Freemasonry.
I love in your book you talk about the connection between the ancient Masonic myth that somehow Masons go all the way back to the building of the temples. You have found a way, at least philosophically, to tie Masonry back to that without making this direct connection that some Masons make, that, you know, Masonry all started with the building of the pyramids or something like that. You actually, you think that there is a way, at least, that they are the inheritor of a more ancient tradition. Can you explain that?
Certainly. I believe they are the inheritor of that tradition, if only because the idea of sacred geometry begins in the Western world in ancient Egypt. Geometry was a sacred science. It was the pharaoh himself who laid out the dimensions of the pyramids, the dimensions of any of the sacred buildings of ancient Egypt. He did this in consort with a high priestess who was representing the goddess Seshat. And this goddess would orient the building correctly according to the four cardinal directions, or in some cases to the pole star. And then the building would be marked out from that point. The building of the pyramid itself was not only a tomb, but it probably served some occult or mystical or esoteric purpose as well. There's been a lot of material written on that. So we have here at the very first instance of architecture being used for spiritual purposes. And you had to have people who were specialists in this. Anyone who's visited the pyramids or any of the other sacred sites around the world marvels at the precision with which these buildings were erected without modern tools, you know, without modern measurement devices, without the modern science of architecture. So there was a secret to all of this. There was a secret to building of the pyramids. They're still discussing how those things were built. It's still an amazement to most people. And we have that. We have we have Moses famously leading his people out of Egypt. And there's a tradition that the Jews who left Egypt were inheritors of some of the sacred science, which then ties in together Kabbalah. It ties in a lot of Jewish mysticism, mixing it with Egyptian religion and Egyptian mysticism. It becomes a very fascinating, an almost volatile mixture of sacred sciences. If you mix the written Kabbalah with the physical Kabbalah, if you will, of the buildings of the pyramids and the other sacred temples, you have an expression of something divine in stone, something that would last eternally. If only we knew how to read it, if only we knew how to understand the buildings and the orientations and what it signified.
Well, I think that, again, though, just to emphasize that point, that thread then of that sacred geometry was passed down through Masons without necessarily there being anything called, you know, a Masonic group yet, but it just happened to be one of the tools, the intellectual tools of the trade, and that eventually when Masonry does take a more codified form, that's one of the things that comes along with it, is this ancient knowledge, so that's what ties them, if not the actual, any sort of genealogical heritage back to the builders of the pyramid, certainly an intellectual heritage. Is that fair to say?
Yes, it is. It's fair to say. And I think the connection, once again, is in the Middle East. When the Templars first arrived in the Middle East, they were amazed at the fortifications they found there. They had to hire local people to help them build siege engines and other types of war machines in order to invade the various cities of the Middle East to take back Jerusalem, etc. And they brought back these secrets, the secrets of this architecture with them back into Europe. I mean, the Gothic cathedrals would not exist had it not been for the Templars being in the Middle East and bringing back the knowledge. Not only the texts, the texts that have been lost, texts like Plato and the various other Hermetic texts they brought back, but also the secrets of sacred geometry.
Okay. This in itself, I think, is the foundational work we need to have laid down in order to pursue the secret temple. And I really like, in the end, how you tie in that title, the secret temple, with what may actually be sort of the holy grail of Masonry. But it may not be the holy grail that people expect it to be when we talk about the Knights Templar. So let's get back to that. And I want to talk about Masonry, the Knights Templar, the Illuminati, and then we'll get into more of a specific discussion about the way that the cornerstone was laid for this government and where we can see the evidence of Freemasonry in our sacred geometry in Washington, D.C., for example, or in other aspects of our government. We'll get to all of that coming up on Coast to Coast. It's The Secret Temple, and this is Ian Punnett. Peter Levenda's new book is The Secret Temple. It's out in softcover, and you can pick it up tonight. You can link up to Peter through coasttocoastam.com. Highly recommend this read because Peter does such a nice job, I believe, at least in my opinion, of really bringing an objective eye to this material. May not be right on everything, but it's not for lack of research. And I certainly haven't found any holes that I've been looking. And I think when you clearly label your speculation, which I appreciate, and I think it makes it all the more interesting. Let's go back. As soon as we're going to talk about some of the other pieces like Angels and Demons, let's go to Da Vinci Code real quick just to talk about the Knights Templar Freemasonry connection. The charge is that the Knights Templar grew wealthy because they knew the secret that the church didn't want them to know, that Christ was not a divine son of God, but a human prophet. And therefore, the Holy Grail is not a physical thing, but it's the bloodline of Christ through his wife, Mary Magdalene. That this was the power of the Knights Templar. You want to address that?
Oh, sure. I mean, the Knights Templar were exposed to non-traditional religious ideas while they were in the Middle East, while they were in Palestine. So the possibility that they came into contact with Gnostic sects that believed this way, or that believed that the John the Baptist was the real savior, if you will, that Jesus was second to John the Baptist, that's been one of the theories as well that they were exposed to. There was a great deal of speculation as to the rituals the Knights Templar themselves practiced, their initiation rituals, which they said involved a trampling of the cross and a denial of Christ's resurrection. Recently, just really in the last couple of months, some documents were released from the Vatican archives which seemed to indicate that some of what was believed to be heretical acts by the Templars were really not. I mean, the Templars came off now being really very Christian, very Catholic in their points of view.
Very traditional in their points of view.
Yes, they do come off this way. With the new documentation, we can go back and say, okay, now we understand what was going on. But even more startlingly is the idea that the famous head that they were supposedly worshiping in secret was actually the Shroud of Turin. This is the latest bombshell that's just been released. So there's a lot of speculation now about what was really taking place with the Templars. But from my point of view, they did come in contact with a lot of strange religious beliefs out there in Palestine. Of course, they were exposed to Muslim ideas about Jesus. And, of course, the Muslims don't believe that Jesus was divine. They deny his divinity, as do the Jews. So there's a monotheistic trend out there which says there's only one God and, you know, that's it. Jesus could not possibly have been God. So the Templars were exposed to that.
And they were in relationship with the assassins. I mean, we know that the assassins as a group were the Knights Templar of Islam.
Yes, they were. And they were the mystical branch also. The assassins come from a very deeply mystical tradition. In fact, it was so mystical at one point they were considered completely heretical by the other Muslims. They just went off the deep end. But they did believe there was knowledge that was exoteric that everybody could get from their religious leaders, and there was a knowledge that was esoteric, that was hidden. And this hidden knowledge is what the assassins believed they had connections to, that they understood.
But there was no primary source material that you have found that backs up this claim that somehow in the Middle Ages the Knights Templar had their power from maintaining this Holy Grail secret.
I believe there was something going on there, and I'll say why. The Knights Templar took oaths. The original nine knights, they took oaths of poverty, chastity, and obedience. They gave up all of their lands, all of their resources to the church. They became poor knights essentially. They went to the Middle East. They camped out at the site of Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem. And they returned a few years later and started, you know, financing all sorts of projects. They became wealthy. They became powerful mysteriously. It's still mysterious as to how they did that. It's still mysterious as to who financed the building of all those Gothic cathedrals. The sums of money that would have been involved were enormous. And yet within a space of 100 years, all of these cathedrals throughout France are being built. So the Templars became inordinately wealthy inordinately quickly. We don't know exactly how that happened. They might have found something at the temple that was very important. They might have been blackmailing someone with what they found.
And I honestly, I've never found any material on that. The only thing I've ever found on that comes from speculation of the last you know, 50 or 60 sure. years. I mean, there's nothing to it to me, and I've been researching it too. So I'm a tad disappointed that you leave the door open so wide on that. And I would tell you that other research I've shown said exactly what you just said in your first sentence is really the key. People wanted to be a part of the Freemasonry. They were donating land left and right and in order to become a Knights Templar.
Right.
And that this communal property, this was how they accumulated wealth so fast, is the Knights Templar were the rock stars. They were the Marines. They were the Army Rangers. People wanted to be a part of it, and they were willing to give up. The lords that were willing to throw their property and everything into the pot is what suddenly went from 0 to 60 for the Knights Templar coffers.
Yeah, I understand that line of reasoning as well, but you have to remember there were competing orders of knighthood also, the Knights Hospitaller being probably their most famous rivals
right.
in the Middle East. And the Knights Hospitaller never really got to the position the Templars did, even with all the donations that were, you know, floating all over the place. But that still doesn't explain how the cathedrals were built. This is the thing that I've always found interesting, that I've always tried to understand who financed all of that and how quickly all these churches went up, you know, all throughout France. I mean, the cost in terms of human resources and finances and material resources was really quite considerable. Yes, the Templars, of course, were getting money donated to them. They were part of the church, after all, so you could donate to the Knights Templar and get all of these spiritual benefits as you would from donating to the Pope or anything else. But they did become powerful in their own right.
Yep.
I mean, they were so powerful they had to be suppressed eventually.
Yeah, and I understand that, and that that does get to the conversation that about the transference between the Knights Templar and the Masons. Now, we're talking about a span of roughly 100 years from the end of the Knights Templar to the very first formal wording about Masonry. Can you talk about that?
Yes, the Templars, as people who read the Dan Brown books would know, were suppressed early in the 14th century, about 1307 to about 1317. The Templars were suppressed by the Church and by the King of France, Philippe le Bel, at the time. So the Pope and the King of France got together, suppressed the Templars. The reasons are a little murky. They have to do with finances, certainly. That was one of the major reasons. Charges of heresy were brought up against them. They were suppressed. Fine. Well, towards the end of that same century, I mean, within about 80 years after the death of the Grand Master of the Knights Templar, Jacques de Molay, who was burned at the stake, we have the first Masonic manuscript in Scotland. We have the Regius manuscript, and later we have the Cook manuscript a few years after that. And these are manuscripts that specifically refer to Freemasonry as a repository of ancient secrets and as an initiatory order. This is hundreds of years before the official beginning of Freemasonry. And this happens in Scotland. So the rumors have always been that the last remaining Knights Templar in England fled to Scotland because there was tension between Scotland and England anyway. The Templars were suppressed in England when the Pope began suppressing them in France and Italy. And some Templars did escape. They wound up in Scotland. And then within 80 years, we have the first Masonic mysteries being talked about, being published in Scotland and in England. So from my point of view, the argument that there's a connection between the Templars and the Freemasons is not that far-fetched. It is if you think the Templars were suppressed in 1307 and then the first Freemasons show up in 1717. Yeah, that's 300 years. That's quite a distance. But my point is that the Templars could not simply be suppressed that easily because these were people who really believed in what they were doing.
Right.
How do you simply say to them, okay, it's all over, go home? I mean, would they simply just go home? The Christian communities were being suppressed for 300 years before they were allowed to have a legal status in the Roman Empire. For 300 years, they met underground. They met in cemeteries. They conducted their ceremonies privately, secretly, under penalty of death. And here's the Freemasons, the Knights Templar, being suppressed viciously throughout Europe. Did they simply just go away?
Did they
hang up their sword?
And I'm with you on that, although it would seem logical that with the Protestant Reformation in Scotland, and Scotland was obviously a country that signed on early in the Protestant Reformation, then also later in England under King Henry, that with the establishment of the Church of England, you think that there would have been a chance for them to have come out of the shadows earlier than 1717. I mean, there was no suppression by the Catholic Church after the Protestant Reformation in Scotland and then later in England.
Sure. There was no suppression then, but by that time we have the Freemasons. We no longer have the Templars. I think the Templars were...
I'm just saying, I think the Freemasons would have come on the radar earlier in a much bigger way after the Reformation. There would have been a bigger presence of them, that they would have come out larger than they came out in 1717.
Well, Elias Ashmole was initiated as a Freemason in the 17th century, about 100 years before the formation of the United Grand Lodge of England. So it was already there. I mean, his initiation records are available. The documents are there.
Right.
So in the 1600s, here's this famous guy, after which the Ashmolean Museum is named.
Right.
One of the foremost thinkers of his time, accepting initiation into a Masonic lodge, you know, long before the 1717 date. I mean, that's a fact.
Right. You're right, and you're right about that in the book, and it's a sound argument. I just mean, as a secret society, in a way, they published the first secrets toward the end of the 14th century.
Right.
I'm just thinking out loud that they would have then taken a larger presence publicly than they did until, you know, the early part of the 18th century. It just would have seemed like there was an opportunity for that. But let me—I don't want to sidetrack you on that. I really enjoyed your research on that. So it conflicts with some of the things I've read. So that's why it's sort of in my brain. But I like how you make the argument, and I think it's a very solid one, that then this is where, in a way, this is the transitional point between the operative Masons, the ones that are actually doing the Masonry work, and the speculative Masons, and the inheritors of the intellectual tradition of that kind of free thinking, ends up with some of the best known names in Western history, like Isaac Newton. And that's fairly verifiable, right? I mean, there's...
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, no, it certainly is. Like I say, Elias Ashmole being one of the first, and you know, one of the founders of the Royal Society, to which Isaac Newton also later belonged, and also involved in Freemasonry. What a lot of people don't know about Newton is that he was very, very much involved in studies of alchemy and of the Bible itself, trying to prove various things biblically, and studies of what we would call Kabbalah today. Isaac Newton was fascinated with this stuff. It probably obsessed him more than the discoveries for which he's more widely known, like the apple falling from the tree, the gravity thing. Newton was very much involved in esoteric research. I mean, this was Freemasonry by that time was becoming an Enlightenment movement. It was preaching something very different, which is one of the things that made me also wonder about a Templar connection. The Templars, of course, had reason to suddenly distrust the Church and the state. Both had suppressed them. The King of France suppressed them, and the head of the Catholic Church suppressed them. So we have a group of people who had given their all for Church and state, essentially, had fought bloody battles, had given up everything, you know, to be part of the Order of Knights Templar, being suppressed by Church and state. And now I'm thinking, here we have the group coming back in a sense, but still distrustful of Church and state, talking about emancipation, talking about liberty. Science as being something that was important, you know, scientific inquiry, open inquiry of science. We have, besides Newton, besides Ashmole, we can say that people like Giordano Bruno, who was burned at the stake in the year 1600, while probably not a Freemason, was still a proponent of the same ideas, the idea of open inquiry, scientific inquiry. He defended, for instance, Galileo, and the idea of the Earth revolving around the sun. All of these concepts were coming into the fore, and I could see that Freemasonry, with its idolizing geometry, sacred geometry, something which can be demonstrated as, you know, works in stone, would have appreciated science as well.
Yeah, so, I want to put a capstone on that a little bit, though, here, just because I know we're coming to the top of the hour. In your research, though, and I think this is really key for people who are trying to understand perhaps the Knights Templar vis-a-vis Dan Brown and then what you had just said a few minutes ago about how recent discoveries in the Vatican's own works show that the Knights Templar had actually been exonerated by the Pope, who had investigated the claims of apostasy, of heresy, and came back and said, no, they weren't guilty of this. It just was not enough to save them at the time. But we have the documents that show that the Pope actually found them Orthodox.
Yes.
And that other documents back up the idea that they were Orthodox. And yet that's reflected in later Masonry, as you understand it, in that the Masons are not maintaining this idea about the idea that Mary Magdalene was the wife of Christ as being their primary secret. Their primary secret involved geometry, involved some of these mysteries that they passed down. But they also were very, I think I'm accurately quoting you when you say they were pro-Christian but anti-Catholic.
Well, yes. I mean, the feeling was mutual.
Right.
The you were not allowed to become a Freemason if you were a Catholic. The Catholic Church did not allow you to do that. I mean, I remember growing up in the United States in the 1950s and being told, you know,
right.
Friends of mine had belonged to the Mollet Society, right, a Masonic Society for boys. And I was told, oh, no, you're a Catholic. You can't do that. You know?
Right, right.
So, I mean, it was a mutual feeling of distrust between
Oh, yeah. But my point is, and I think this is, and I'm pulling it from your book again, The Secret Temple is what we're talking about, that it backs up the idea that, especially toward the end of the existence of the Knights Templar as we know it, in the early part of the 14th century, you could fairly say, while they're being murdered and imprisoned across Europe, burned alive at the stake,
yeah.
that the Knights Templar were pro-Christian but anti-Catholic, probably toward the end of their existence.
Right.
And in fact, that's just what the Masons end up being,
yes,
pro-Christian but anti-Catholic. And you see, that seems to me a solid thread between those two organizations.
Yes, I agree with you.
Yeah. And so, but that brings us to one of the reasons why the Catholic Church had good reason to distrust the Masons and why they were forbidding anybody who is in full communion with the Church for being Masons. And that brings us to a couple of the other aspects of this conversation, including the Illuminati, which full circle. Now we've come back to Angels and Demons, which is coming out as a movie later on this week. So let's talk about what we do know about the Illuminati and what we think we know about the Illuminati with Peter Lavenda. The book is The Secret Temple, and we still haven't explained what The Secret Temple refers to. I think it's a fascinating idea. And then we'll get into a discussion about Freemasonry and the formation of the United States, specifically Washington, and the symbolism that is all around us. Or is it? We'll get into that coming up. But Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. We're a ways away yet from you joining the conversation, but I promise you, you'll have the chance to. And we've got a lot of ground to cover between now and then that I really want to get to out of The Secret Temple from Peter Lavenda. So let's talk about the Illuminati. They are the antagonists of the of Angels and Demons, depending on, I guess, your point of view on that. But the Illuminati being a supposed multinational secret society, even more powerful and even more secretive than Masonry. What do you think?
Well, no.
I knew the answer, but I was just giving you an easy setup there to spike it over the net. All right, so say no and why.
Well, of course, the Illuminati did exist. It was a real organization. There's no doubt at all about that. It was founded in 1776, oddly enough, within only a few weeks before we would write our own Declaration of Independence and basically secede from Great Britain. So these ideas were around at the time, and the Illuminati was probably the perfect group to give, you know, fuel to the fire of conspiracy theorists, because what the creator of the Illuminati wanted to do, a man called Adam Weishaupt, he was a professor of theology in Bavaria at the University of Ingolstadt. What he wanted to do was to use Freemasonry, use the Masonic lodges as his own base, as a network to penetrate into various political arenas around Europe at the time. So he wanted to use the Freemasons to penetrate them, to use them, and to eventually take over, take control of Freemasonry for his own ends.
We might say piggyback.
Yes, you could say that.
Yeah,
and it was a diabolical plot, you could say. He was much more extreme than the Masons were when it came to ideas like personal liberty, freedom, etc. I think that Weishaupt came much closer to an atheistic kind of point of view, even though he was a Jesuit and even though he was a professor, a doctor of theology. He was very, very radical in his ideas. And he did want to overthrow various European governments. I mean, that was what he was about. So it scared everyone. And I believe that although they were suppressed really early on, Weishaupt had to go and escape. He was deported, essentially, went into exile, and died. Still writing tracts about the new man that he wanted to create, the new human being, sort of the next step of evolution, and all of this. I believe there was a definite definite Illuminati influence on the French Revolution. People asked George Washington if he believed the Illuminati had anything to do with the events in the new colonies, in the new United States, as it was fighting England. And Washington said Illuminatist ideas probably were in the United States, but that the Freemasons were not part of that. He did not subscribe to them. George Washington, as we know, was a Freemason. He believed in Masonic ideas, but he rejected the Illuminati completely. I think we could safely say they were suppressed successfully in the 19th century, that they never really came back again after the early 1800s. But the rumors about them, the legends, of course, they just grew and grew. So at one point there was a bit of an Illuminati hysteria in the United States. They thought the Illuminati people were everywhere. And then, of course, that morphed into the Masonic hysteria in the early 1800s also. So you had a lot of paranoia about these secret societies, and justifiably so, if you think about it.
Right. Well, and, yeah, here you have a nascent country, or a country taking its first, baby steps into toddlerhood, and everything looked like a threat. It almost like a new mother looking around a living room and seeing every corner of every coffee table as a potential threat. It was a sensitive time. Nobody knew how many footsteps were going to be able to put in front of each other before the whole experiment could fall apart. So, maybe hyper sensitive to anybody coming in and creating a government within this government and taking it over. I think that's a great transition into then how many of the founding fathers, as you research it, as you can prove it, were Masons? How many of them could we say were fellow travelers with the Masonic ideals? And how much of a role does that play in the formation of the United States?
I think that Masonic ideals were what really contributed to the revolution. I think that if we think of Freemasonry as a laboratory for Enlightenment ideas, the kind of ideas promoted by Voltaire and Rousseau and John Locke and all the other philosophers of freedom, of liberty, and all of this, of human responsibility, all of that was going around. And I think the Masonic lodges provided a great place for these people to get together and to discuss these things secretly, because the lodges were, after all, secret. I mean, it was a secret society with secret initiations. And I think that they provided the venue for these discussions. When we talk about the founding fathers, people may be surprised to know that of the 39 signers of the U.S. Constitution, for instance, 13 were Freemasons. That's one-third of the people who signed the Constitution. But even more, of all the commissioned generals of the Continental Army fighting the British, virtually half of all the generals were Freemasons.
We should point out that the generals on the British side were also Freemasons.
Yes, they were.
And that's part of the interesting part about this, is that Freemasonry didn't require that you choose a side. In fact, Freemasonry almost called upon the participants to be loyal to whatever government or under whosoever rule they found themselves.
Well, that's true. In any Masonic lodge, you will find that their political discussions are not allowed and religious discussions are not allowed. You're expected to be loyal to the government of whatever country you happen to be in. But this gave a problem for our founding fathers because, as Freemasons, how could they revolt against England? How could they revolt against George III? Speaking Masonically, they would have to have been loyal to George III. But something happened, you know, something happened between the one side of the Atlantic and the other, where suddenly the Masons in our country decided, well, there's a limit, and this is the limit. And what we're going to do is we're going to create, you know, a new republic. We're going to create a new country based on these Enlightenment, Masonic, if you will, principles, and no one's going to stop us. So you had this weird situation where you had Masons on both sides of that conflict, and fraternally in some cases. But when the Freemasons themselves today, for instance, will tell you no such thing as a Masonic conspiracy, it wasn't Freemasons who created the United States, et cetera, they will almost in the same breath talk about how Masonic lodges were used as safe houses throughout the colonies, where Masons could meet and they could transfer information, transfer funds and everything else. It's a very strange situation we find ourselves in when we talk about the revolution.
I think that's true in my experience, too, in conversations with Masons who, out of one side of their mouth, will talk about how there is no Masonic conspiracy, but then they also take a lot of pride in what even they perceive as being ownership of the United States in a way that both intellectually and also in the symbolism of the United States, that they see Masonry as it's represented in the way in which the United States was claiming itself with its symbols. I'll hold on that for just a second, just so we can wrap up the discussion about the Founding Fathers, because I love how you phrase it in the book, that the book The Secret Temple, that it's not just the Founding Fathers that end up signing the Declaration of Independence, but we could really look at it, and there's a long line of Europeans, in a way, that are signing the Declaration of Independence at the same time.
Right. I mean, from my point of view, because I see what was taking place as an Enlightenment movement, the European Enlightenment, which involved a lot of the French philosophers and French thinkers. I mean, Voltaire was initiated into the Lodge of Nine Sisters in Paris, which was a hotbed of revolutionary thought and ideas. And he was brought to that initiation by Benjamin Franklin. So, you know, Benjamin Franklin, who was a Mason, who actually, on his printing press, the very first Masonic book in the United States, or in the American colonies at that time, was published, The Constitutions of Freemasonry. So Benjamin Franklin was very much involved in Freemasonry on both sides of the Atlantic, very much involved in France.
Yeah.
He was in communication with these Enlightenment philosophers. And from my point of view, the American Revolution was signed not just by our own Masonic founding fathers, but also by all of these thinkers like John Locke and like Voltaire and Rousseau and the others who contributed the ideas that led to what would become this great experiment in this country.
Let's talk about the sacred geometry of Washington quickly then, too. Both of the man and of later on the city that's named in his honor, one of the most famous paintings of Washington shows him wearing his Masonic apron. What does that painting, what should we see in that painting? What is that painting making a claim for?
Well, he's laying the cornerstone of the U.S. Capitol building. There has been a lot of discussion recently as to the real spiritual significance of the U.S. Capitol, and I think it's something that Americans should be aware of and should be sensitive to when they visit the nation's capital and they visit the Capitol building. By laying that cornerstone that way, the cornerstone, the foundation stone that way, allowing himself to be painted wearing the Masonic regalia and with a lot of other Masons in attendance, they were making a statement about how the United States was founded, what it was founded on, the types of principles it was founded upon. Freemasonry was intended to be the unity of all men, and I say that very deliberately because women were not allowed to be Freemasons. That's another part of the discussion for a little later on, maybe. But
or the unity of all white men, we should say.
Of all white men, we should also stipulate, all white men. But it was at least a step in the right direction, and it was intended to show that there was there were no superiors or inferiors. I mean, if you joined a Masonic lodge and if you were a prince, it was just as likely that you would be initiated by a commoner as it would be by another nobleman. I mean, within the lodge, there were no social ranks. Everyone was equal, according to your degree, first, second, or third. So you had no distinctions of race, of class, or anything within the temple itself. There were, of course, problems. They did not allow women to be initiated. They did not allow black people to be initiated because of a rule that said you cannot be the child of a slave. There was all sorts of other things. You could not be handicapped and become a Freemason. So there's a lot of things they had to work on, from my point of view,
right,
in order to achieve this, you know, human liberty and equality concept. But it was there. They were striving for it. They were trying to get there. And the first thing they had to do was get rid of a monarchy, get rid of a bloodline of rulers, and say that we're going to elect our own rulership and be free. So the U.S. Capitol is a manifestation of that. An author called William Henry has written about this and done lectures on it,
right,
on the mystical significance of the U.S. Capitol building, so I won't step on his toes on that. And one of my colleagues, James Wasserman, wrote a book called The Secrets of Masonic Washington, where he talks about the architecture and the various buildings and statues. You can't go anywhere in Washington, D.C. without bumping into a statue of a Freemason somewhere.
Right.
And that's because so many of our founding fathers were. Paul Revere was a Freemason.
Not to mention just statues of Freemasons in Washington that were not founding fathers.
That were not founding fathers, right, just Freemasons.
Right, Albert Pike.
Albert Pike being probably the most famous example.
Yeah.
So, I mean, our nation's capital is a monument to Freemasonry in many respects, and that's not a bad thing. A lot of people look at Freemasonry as a problem, as a society bent on world domination or something. There's no pope in Freemasonry. There's no one big organizational head that determines what Freemasons do. Lodges are pretty much independent. I don't see Freemasonry as a threat. There are other organizations that I distrust, but Freemasonry in general is not one of them. There have been Masonic conspiracies. The Freemasons are loath to discuss them, but the famous case in Italy of Propaganda Due, the Masonic scandal that rocked Italy, that had so many tentacles around the world, that was one. But that was a criminal enterprise for the most part. That was organized crime and right-wing politics and a lot of other stuff mixed in together. But as far as Freemasonry itself is concerned, the ideals that they brought to the founding of this country, I think, were essentially pure. They really did want to create a free and democratic republic.
And I think that's interesting. And I like how you go into in your book kind of their problem they had, Masons had, in getting over racial issues, anti-Semitism,
yeah,
and really kind of, if not misogyny, at least discrimination on the basis of women not being worthy, and still there's a problem with that in my opinion. But I'm not a Mason. But I think it's interesting when you talk about that there was no monarchy, and part of the claim of that whole Knight Templar keeper of the Holy Grail as Mary Magdalene as the Holy Grail, you know, wife of Christ thing, is to maintain the divine right of kings.
Right.
And so, I go back to, I just don't see that that's a Knights Templar position. If the Masons really are inheritors of the Knights Templar worldview, the first thing they get rid of is the divine right of kings.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I just don't see that as being something which the Knights Templar would have actually maintained. But again, I don't want to sound like I'm fixated on that. I just happen to think the Knights Templar are too cool for the way that they're often described.
There you go. I tend to agree with you on that one.
Okay. So, getting back to the Masons then, and this, there's an upcoming novel by Dan Brown. We don't know a lot about it. It's The Solomon Key, is one of the titles it's known by, and it's about Freemasonry and the CIA and the Freemasonry and some of the conspiracies in the United States. I do think it's interesting to point out that that Freemasonry was really tested during the Civil War, as again, general versus general, they could both have been Masons. They might have both been from the same Masonic lodge and then found themselves on the opposite sides of the war.
Right, that's correct. I mean, Freemasonry in our country has had a tremendous influence on events, on historical events around us. We just don't always recognize them as such. The Civil War was one example. But just prior to the Civil War, there was the anti-Masonic hysteria where there was an abduction, a kidnapping of a man who was threatening to reveal Masonic secrets, and he disappeared and was never found again. He was believed to have been murdered. This started a wave of anti-Masonic feelings. People thought that there were Masons everywhere, that they were going to take over the country, they were murdering people and all this other stuff. I think part of the problem stems from the fact that Masons are secret, and we don't tend to believe that anybody who's secret is doing anything any good.
Yeah, that's the way I feel about my teenagers. I know when they're trying to keep a secret, I know it's not going to be a good one. All right, so let's put on this this conversation on hold for just a second for Peter Lavenda. Then we'll come back because I want to ask what he knows about a famous story about the Civil War and Freemasonry. I want to throw at Peter Lavenda a little bit more about the possibility that Knights Templar ships might have arrived in the U.S. I didn't see that in the book, but I'm just curious whether in his research he saw anything on that. It goes back to our discussion a couple of weeks ago about the Kensington Runestone, which is here in Minnesota. And then let's move forward, too, into what the real meaning of the secret temple is, according to Peter Lavenda. And then also a little history of the Mormon Church as he sees it. Coming up on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Peter Lavenda, the author of The Secret Temple. So where were we? The history of the United States. The Masonic mysteries, especially as they pertain to the founding of America. What about the sacred geometry of Washington? We were talking about a little bit. A caller brought up something I hadn't heard, that the line, the ley line between Washington, D.C. all the way up to Boston doesn't deviate 1 degree. Have you ever heard about that? Is that ever anything you come across?
No, this is news to me. I haven't looked at that.
I hadn't heard that either. I'll put that away. Now, how about this, though? We had a guest on a couple Sundays ago. He's actually a guy I know here in town. He's a geologist by trade. He is a forensic geologist, actually. Does really interesting work working in court cases, lawsuits, testing stone, determining the age of stone. And he was brought in to work on the Kensington Runestone. Do you know what that is?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Okay. So the Kensington Runestone story is that just before the turn of the last century here in Minnesota, a farmer finds this stone with ancient runes on it, and what would seemingly be a couple of references to a group having been either lost or cut off up at the headwaters of the Mississippi and some other rivers here in the upper Midwest. And he finds this stone and these runes, which then later on he can trace specifically to an island, Gotland, which is off of Norway, right? Or Denmark. Denmark. I can't remember all of a sudden. Anyway, but on this island there's a particular Cistercian abbey, which, of course, the Cistercians have a connection to the Knights Templar. And so the author argues that the Knights Templar, who were well-known explorers, would have left this stone here in Minnesota, and in the years is also right there in the 14th century. Where are you with something like that? And what about other references to the Knights Templar having made it to the New World before Columbus?
Well, in Sinister Forces, in the first volume of that, I talk about the Kensington Stone a little bit. And some of the other artifacts that have come to light. The Kensington Stone was believed to have been a forgery for so long, and then eventually it was proved that it was genuine runic letters, and you know, there's no doubt about it now.
Right.
So that's only one of many. There's a lot of different of stones, petroglyphs in the United States that are evidence that the North America was visited by Europeans and by people from the Mediterranean hundreds of years before Columbus. I think it's a definite possibility, based on that kind of evidence, the work that was done by Barry Fell, for instance, years ago, the late Barry Fell, a professor at Harvard, who was fascinated with these stones and what they signified, that we have been visited here many times in the past. I think the Templars are a good candidate also. I've read some of the literature. Some of it's very speculative. But some of it, there's room there to believe that perhaps the Templars, in trying to find a place to escape to, especially from Portugal and Spain, which were the last countries to really suppress the Templars, they took a long time before they got around to doing that. The Templars were safe there for a while, and these are maritime countries. And then, they set sail. There was even a rumor that Columbus, that his ships bore the Templar crosses. You know, the red crosses on the white background.
I've heard that. Is that just a historical rumor?
Well, it's a fact that his ships, the sails bore those symbols. Whether or not that indicated a Templar connection or not, of course, that's still kind of speculative. We really don't know.
But it's interesting you should bring that up, the red cross on the white. And that's clear enough of a symbol, or simple enough of a symbol, that we wouldn't necessarily mean it has to be Templar, but
right.
it sure looked like it, didn't it?
It sure did.
And the fact that would explain, in a way, how Columbus would have gotten so much of this information about the New World. But all right, well, putting that aside for the moment, then let's then take a little bit of time here to talk about something else, which I thought was very intriguing in your book. That there are some institutions which we don't think of as secret societies, but you make the claim that, for example, the Church of the Latter-day Saints, the Mormon Church, that has a strong Masonic connection, and that the symbols and the traditions of a lot of Freemasonry, or at least the practices of Freemasonry, are still alive in the church today. Can you make that connection?
Sure. I mean, it all goes back to Joseph Smith himself, the founder of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, what we call the Mormons. If we understand that America, in the first couple of hundred years of its existence, was steeped in esoteric arts, there was a governor of Connecticut, Winthrop, who was very involved in alchemy, in their hermetic sciences and all of that. And this is long before even the Salem witchcraft trials, you know, became famous. There was a lot of this involvement by the early founding fathers before the revolution in things of this nature. There was a widespread literature on this that was available to a lot of people. And Joseph Smith, in the very early 1800s, was involved as a farm boy, was involved in rituals of what we call ceremonial magic. He was drawing talismans, drawing magic circles. He had implements that he took with him. He would go out to the woods near his home and essentially conjure angels or spirits to appearance, to visible appearance, in an effort to find buried treasure. And this was something that was going around. This was a kind of practice that a lot of people did. Joseph Smith had what he called a seer stone. This was like a crystal ball that he would gaze into to discover secrets and to talk with the spirits. Joseph Smith was heavily involved in the occult as a young man, as a young boy, and as a young man. And then later, it was his practice of these rituals that led to the creation of the Book of Mormon. He claimed that the angel Moroni had appeared to him, shown him the tablets and the scrolls on which the Book of Mormon was written in hieroglyphics, and then he would write down the Book of Mormon, and then the tablets would go back into the ground or back to the angels, and the Book of Mormon was written based upon these rituals that he performed in the woods of upstate New York.
Now, let me just jump in and ask, what's your source material for that?
Oh, probably the best source material for this is a book by D. Michael Quinn about the magic and Mormonism. It's a huge volume, heavily, heavily referenced, footnoted, with photographs of some of the talismans that Joseph Smith owned that were on his person when he died. He was killed by an angry mob. Some of the things that he was carrying are represented there. Some of the books and materials that he used are there. This is not a secret. The Mormons had liked to keep it a secret for a long time, but it eventually came out. And Michael Quinn himself, I think, was chased around the country a little bit. The Mormons were very upset with the fact that he published this very comprehensive source book on this material. There's no doubt about it. Part of the famous Mormon murder case of about 20 years ago or so was based upon the fact that a forger had come up with what he said was a letter that implied that Joseph Smith was conjuring demons. And the Mormons paid a great deal of money to get this letter back and put it in the archives. Later, it was revealed to be a forgery. But the Mormons were aware of this. They are still aware of this information. It's there. And then later on, he became involved in Freemasonry, and this was very unusual also.
Yeah, and I think this must be public knowledge because you have this. This would have been, it seemed like at the time, even something which would have been known in his lifetime that he had become a Mason, and that several other people within the Latter-day Saints movement joined at the same time he did.
This is also quite public knowledge. In fact, it was the Mormons at one point who had the largest Masonic lodges in the state of Illinois. I mean, Joseph Smith, after he became initiated, began initiating like crazy. So there were a lot of Mormons brought into Freemasonry at that time.
Then the question is begged, though, so what? Okay, so he becomes a Freemason like a lot of other people of faith do and create this sort of universalist bond of brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what is that? Where does that lead in terms of where you think the Mormon Church goes?
Well, there's a couple of points I should make. The first one is Joseph Smith was the prophet of Mormonism. He created that religion. Now, can you imagine Muhammad becoming a Freemason, or Jesus becoming a Freemason, or Moses becoming a Freemason? You know, so that there is something that you have to sit back and stop and say, well, you had a direct connection already to the divine. You were already channeling divine forces, at least as far as you're concerned, you were. You're writing scriptures. You're creating this entire religious movement. What do you need Freemasonry for, then? What is the point?
Well, and then I'm reminded of the conversation we had about Adam Weishaupt, that maybe he saw taking over Freemasonry as the fast track to establishing Mormon churches all over the United States, that if he could infiltrate it in that way, change people's hearts and minds to the prophetic vision he was having, it would be the fastest way to create a national, you know, church organization.
Well, very good. Very good idea. It could have been strictly a political maneuver. But what happened eventually was that Joseph Smith incorporated so much Masonic ritual into secret degrees within the Mormon Church, the so-called temple endowment ceremonies and some of the other secret rites that only Mormons who have passed certain qualifications may actually participate in or observe in the temple, in the Mormon temple in Salt Lake City and in some of the other Mormon temples around. I mean, these are based on Masonic temples. These have Masonic symbolism there. The so-called magic underwear that people make fun of that the Mormons wear is a copy of the Masonic apron. I mean, what Smith did was he not only became involved in Freemasonry, he took Masonic ideas and put them into Mormonism and made the higher levels of the Mormon Church more resemble Masonic lodges than anything else. It's incredible. I mean, the amount of Masonic symbolism that he took over, ritual and ideas and concepts, into Mormonism really makes you ask a lot of questions. I mean, what was the purpose of that? You know, it's no longer an attempt to penetrate Freemasonry and to use Freemasonry. It's become part of Mormon religious life.
Okay. And you make an interesting statement in the book that somebody who is a Freemason would walk, if they could walk into the Holy of Holies in the Church of the Latter-day Saints, they would see a lot of similarities and a lot of familiar sort of environments and symbols. And the same thing, too, with somebody who is raised Mormon, for them to go into a Masonic lodge, it would look very familiar and it would feel familiar. Basically.
Oh, absolutely. I think that they would all feel quite familiar and be very comfortable with the surroundings. I think that what happened was that Joseph Smith did see something very valuable in Freemasonry. He embraced it wholeheartedly. And remember, it was at a time of anti-Masonic hysteria in the United States. You know, the Northeast was undergoing a tremendous pressure. The Masonic lodges were being shut down everywhere. People were afraid to show up for the rituals. But suddenly out in the Midwest, in Ohio and Illinois and further west, we see Joseph Smith really promoting Freemasonry in a big way, getting as many of his people as possible to join and become involved with Freemasonry. He saw something there, and I think it goes back to his early beginnings, conjuring spirits in upstate New York and using medieval sorcerer's work books to do this.
All right.
I think there's a connection there. I think that's part of it.
Well, I want to allow you to explore something which I'd never heard of before, and it was intriguing. I've always been curious about the word Mormon. I did years ago, challenged, I think, actually by a caller on Coast to Coast. I did a word study on the word Mormon, and I found it very unsatisfactory. You speculate about a connection for the word Mormon and how Joseph Smith might have come up with it, if it hadn't in fact been handed to him by a prophet, by an angel in a prophetic dream. Talk to me about what you think the connection might be between the word Mormon and the Masonic controversies of the early part of the 19th century.
Wow. Okay. Well, it's probably more what you're talking about is the angel Moroni, I think, and the word Mormon. Both of these things are very, very mysterious ideas, and we don't, there's been speculation about it. But we have to remember that there was a murder that took place in the early days of before Joseph Smith became the Joseph Smith we all know.
And not far from where he lived.
There was the famous Morgan affair. What happened was a man called William Morgan, who was a Freemason, wanted to publish the rituals of Freemasonry, for whatever reason. No one really knows if it was just a pecuniary thing, he wanted to make some money or what. But his brothers in the craft said, no, you're not. And there was a big discussion over this, and what happened was Morgan disappeared. It's believed he was murdered by Freemasons in order to protect the secrets. Remember, in those days, the oaths were taken very seriously, and you took an oath to have your eyes plucked out and your disemboweled and all the rest of it if you broke the law and revealed the secrets. So he disappeared. He was gone. And there was speculation as to what happened to him. Well, there was a newspaper article written about this whole thing, and it's possible that the name Morgan came from two different words.
The word Mormon came from two different words.
Right.
Okay. Not Morgan. Right. Morgan, no. That Morgan, the name of the victim, the purported victim, and then what else?
And the name of a body that was discovered that was believed to have been Morgan, who was actually one of a guy called Timothy Monroe, which was spelled M-O-N-R-O in the newspapers of the time. But because of the way they set the type, the syllables were broken. The name Morgan had been broken into two syllables, More and Gan. And directly below the More syllable in the newspaper was the name of Monroe, M-O-N-R-O. So we have this placement of More Monroe, or Mormon. And it's believed that that's where the name Mormon came from, was this very strange newspaper article about the death of William, the purported death of William Morgan, the discovery of the body of Timothy Monroe, who was believed to have been William Morgan. It's all very complicated. But that the word Mormon came from the conflation of those two names, of Morgan and Monroe. But what's interesting is that William Morgan's widow then marries Joseph Smith.
Which is still one of the most amazing things, that the very, and becomes one of his plural wives.
Yes. Just think about that for a second. I mean, what other stronger case can you make for Joseph Smith's interest in Freemasonry beyond his own initiations? Is the fact that he goes and he marries the widow of the man who was believed to have caused the anti-Masonic hysteria by his disappearance. It's
very
fascinating stuff.
It is. Well, the phones have been ringing like crazy. Everybody wants to talk to Peter Lavenda, the author of The Secret Temple. There are two things left that we haven't gotten to yet, one of which is the meaning of The Secret Temple, and I won't forget to get to that. And then I also want to go over a quick little piece from the Civil War, and I want to get Peter Lavenda on whether or not there's any truth to that Masonic story. That's what this book is all about, and I think it's very well researched. Agree with them or not, it's footnoted at the end of every paragraph, and there's something there to follow up. Masons, Mysteries, and the Founding of America, Peter Lavenda. You'll join the conversation coming up next. And then I remind you, too, that if you want to go back and stream link and listen to that interview we had about the Kensington runestone, I'm even more compelled by the compelling new evidence of the Kensington runestone. That was a couple of weeks ago on a Sunday on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So about the Civil War story, I just wanted you to address. I've always been curious about it and just didn't know whether or not you, Peter Lavenda, came across this in your research, that in Sherman's march to the sea, well, maybe even more specifically, in his march to Atlanta and then to the sea, that he would spare the houses of Confederate soldiers, more specifically, I guess, officers, who had marked their houses with secret temple, you know, symbols from masonry. Any word on that?
I've heard the same rumor. Unfortunately, I don't have any documentation to support it. I've just heard people citing each other on this, but I haven't really seen the original proof or the original documents of this.
Was there a tradition of that, of even the Revolutionary War or at other times when a Masonic general was facing another Masonic general, that they would cut deals with each other?
Again, there's rumors of that as well, and that's something that hasn't come out. I mean, we have had instances where there seems to have been some sort of cooperation, but we don't know if it was based on some sort of Masonic understanding or just the exigencies of the time. There is a tradition within Freemasonry that another Mason must come to your aid if you ask, will no one help the widow's son, if you make the Masonic distress call, identifying yourself as a Mason. Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, tried to do this, according to the story, in the last moments of his life when he was about to be executed by the mob in Carthage. He is said to have made the Masonic distress sign, believing that no Mason would hurt him. Yeah.
Who is the widow's son? What does that refer to?
Wow. Well, that refers to Hiram Abiff, the sacred founder, in a sense, of Freemasonry, the man whose murder is reenacted in the third degree initiation ceremony. He's the person who was building Solomon's temple. He was supposedly the son of a widow.
And then, as long as we get to that, the secret temple itself, I like the way you describe that in your conclusion. Is it Albert Pike who's credited with that?
Yes, Albert Pike, the founder of, the head of Scottish Rite Freemasonry in the United States. There's a huge statue of Albert Pike in Washington, D.C. He's the one who's credited with saying that the secret temple is really human consciousness itself. And it's a very beautiful idea. The secret temple, generally speaking, would refer to the Masonic temple. But the Masonic temple is itself only a metaphor for King Solomon's temple, which is, again, another connection to the Templars. But Solomon's temple no longer exists. It was destroyed 3,000 years ago. So it has become internalized for the believers. Solomon's temple is our own consciousness. When we try to elevate our consciousness, when we try to attain higher states of awareness, of consciousness, of spiritual perfection, we are entering the secret temple. And that's what I believe those three initiatory degrees are meant to suggest. Freemasonry is the preparation of the human mind to be open to these other realities, to experience the death and rebirth of the third degree ceremony, I think is to enter into the very front door of the secret temple of human consciousness, of beginning to understand human consciousness.
And I saw an interesting connection there, too. I just made a note. We'll get back to it after Sam in New York and a couple other people with questions and comments for Peter Lavenda. Sam?
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. I had a question. I heard a discussion one time with some gentlemen that called themselves scholars, and basically they were discussing how there's a correlation between the Mayans and we'll say the Lost Tribe of Israel, that they migrated from this certain part of the world, and they built pyramids in, you know, South America, stuff like that. And I'm just wondering if there's any connection with of what you're getting into.
All right. Peter?
Well, you know, philosophically, yes. I mean, the Mayan temples are examples of sacred geometry, and they mimic in many ways the building of the pyramids in Egypt and some of the other sacred architecture of the Middle East. So from that point of view, we could say that there's a connection. You brought up the Kensington Stone earlier, Ian, and the idea that there were travelers from Europe or other evidence suggests the Middle East to North America hundreds of years before Columbus. There's an idea there may be a connection there. It may not be able to be proved with any degree of certainty right now, but certainly philosophically, you could say the builders of the Mayan temples were philosophical heirs of the pyramid builders and of the builders of Solomon's temple.
And it's possible that there was enough traveling going on already at that point on the high seas that they might have picked up or shared information that could have ended up in the pyramids, the Mayan pyramids.
Oh, I think so. I think we're on the verge of discovering this, I think. There's been so much evidence that's been ignored or neglected by archaeologists like the Kensington Stone, which are evidence of transatlantic and even trans-Pacific travel by the ancient peoples. There's no reason to suspect that Christopher Columbus was the first or Leif Erikson was the first. We can go back much further than that, I'm sure.
West of the Rockies, Carol is in Washington on Coast to Coast AM. Is that the state or the city, Carol?
Hoquiam, Washington.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, my dad was a Shriner. He's passed away now, but I have his thing here that says when he first began with this June 55. Well, anyway, I have always believed that Jesus was a Mason. My dad told me that. I believed him.
What would be the connection there? I don't know if I get it.
Well, even in the Bible, it says that Jesus worked with his dad in building.
As a carpenter?
Yeah.
Okay.
And my dad was in construction, so he was heavy into that. And I'm looking at his order here, the one he first began. There's three pyramids there, and this is, I'm surprised, he belonged to the Uffizi temple. I'm finding this more fascinating. I'm going to read this book, one of them. I got his library, Progress and Poverty by Henry George.
I think you're going to enjoy the book quite a bit. Any thought on Jesus as a Mason?
Well, the connection with Jesus as a Mason is probably one that we've all heard if we have a Christian Catholic background. Jesus as the cornerstone. It's a reference that's made a lot as the cornerstone of the temple, which is a very Masonic term, you know, a very Masonic concept. I don't say that Jesus was a Mason. I don't know if I would go that far, but I know that in many Masonic traditions, they tend to include a lot of the famous spiritual leaders of the past in their role, essentially, by just claiming a lineage spiritually from people like that.
I got to be honest with you. I don't associate the metaphor cornerstone. I associate the metaphor of the keystone with masonry more than I do cornerstone. Cornerstone's too fundamental to make some specific reference to. Anybody could lay down a cornerstone. The keystone was really the part that reflected the true geometric understanding of the Masons. Would you not agree?
I think that's a very perceptive remark, I think, just now.
Okay.
I think, yes, if you remove the keystone, of course, from the building, then you have structural problems.
Right.
Whereas the cornerstone, well, of course, you remove the cornerstone, you do too. But
anybody can put down a cornerstone. It really took a Mason to understand the load-bearing design of a keystone, and that would be where their value came into it. Was not, you know, lugging a cornerstone around, but when, where, and how to put the keystone in. Let's go to Greg in Philly on Coast to Coast AM, first time caller line for Peter Lavenda. Greg, Greg once, Greg twice. Sorry about that. We tried. Let's go to Kenny in Florida on Coast to Coast AM. Kenny,
hey, how you doing, guys?
Good. You're talking with Peter Lavenda.
Yeah, hey, and Peter, I got two questions. One, Peter, you're familiar with Morals and Dogma by Albert Pike?
Sure, of course.
Okay, how about my question is, what's your thoughts on the excerpt from that book, Morals and Dogma, as a Masonic book that, let's say, prefers Lucifer over Adonai, the god of Christians and Jews? And the second question is, are you familiar with the supposed writing by Albert Pike that has supposedly laid out the plans for World War One, Two, and Three? That's supposedly in some museum in London or something. So those are my two questions.
Okay, Kenny, I'll see what I can do. On the second part of your question, I don't know anything about a document by Albert Pike talking about world wars. I'd be fascinated to see it, of course. Pike wrote a lot. He was a very educated, very well-educated, learned person who spoke a lot of different ancient languages, Hebrew, Arabic, et cetera. He had a very strong background in all of that. Anything is possible. As far as morals and dogma is concerned and Lucifer, yes, that's an idea that's come down a lot. I mean, Blavatsky, in forming the Theosophical Society, also spoke of Lucifer in that sense. But they translate the word Lucifer as being the person who brings light. In the Catholic Church, there was a rank. There was a person in the church who carried the candles, and they were called Lucifers, just as the person who carried the incense was called a Thurifer. So,
or the person that carries the cross is the crucifer.
Right, exactly.
Right.
So you have these people. I mean, the person who carried the light was not considered Satan in the church. Obviously, they were carrying candles, and they were Lucifers. So, yes, I do understand the point that the caller is making, that Kenny is making, that there is some kind of idolatry of a demonic force within Freemasonry, but I don't see it. I mean, on the whole, even reading Pike's Morals and Dogma, which is a very thick book but very well done, I don't see devil worship as being central to Masonry, no more than it is to the Theosophical Society.
Yeah, okay, but maybe by the time of Albert Pike, maybe like other people had attempted to do, he was ready to move Masonry in a direction using his influence that was consistent with him. It may not have been consistent with the origins of Masonry,
right.
but if it was a belief that he held, why couldn't we see that connection?
If only because in the context of what he wrote, Morals and Dogma is not really a satanic Bible, if you will. You know, I mean, there's a lot in there about spirituality from a more conservative mainstream point of view. It's possible he was getting into something more Gnostic by talking about Lucifer. There's a Gnostic tradition, of course, that the creator of the world was not God, but it was what they call a demiurgos, a kind of satanic figure that created the world, and that the serpent in the Garden of Eden was actually God. The God that should be worshipped. So the Gnostics had turned it completely around. And that was a very strong tradition in the Middle East for a long time. And they didn't consider themselves satanic at all. I mean, they consider themselves, you know, God-fearing people, but they reinterpreted scripture a little bit. And that might have been what was going on with Pike.
The idea, somebody mentioned earlier of going to a funeral, and they said that they were at recently at a Masonic funeral, and they actually gave what appeared to be the Hitlerian, you know, Heil Hitler salute. Any thought on that? Is that Masonic?
I would be very surprised at that. I doubt that very much. There are a lot of secret, you know, symbols, a lot of grips and gestures and things. But as far as the Hitlerian salute is concerned, I would doubt it. But also remember something. There's more than one Masonic group out there. There are the Masons that we normally think of as the regular Masons. There are the Scottish Rite Masons, which is a different group from the York Masons. And then there's Co-Masonry, which is a French development, which initiates women, allows women to join, and which is very esoteric and very occult, or at least more so than the other rites. And there's other groups that claim to be Masonic and which really are not legitimately Masonic. So it's hard to keep them all straight sometimes.
David is in Phoenix on Coast to Coast AM. David?
Hi, my name is David. I'm from Phoenix. And my question is very personal. It has to do with my grandfather being a Mason. And he was a Mason all his life as far as, you know, as I knew him. And we went to the Shrine Circus every year and what have you. And there was a point at which he showed me a ring that was on his finger. It was a Masonic ring. And he told me that as the oldest member, the oldest male member of his family, that I would inherit this ring. And he died in 1972, and the ring seems to have disappeared. And nobody in my family admits to knowing anything about that.
So your question is, could they have confiscated it? Is there a tradition of taking the ring back?
what is the significance of the ring, and why was I supposed to inherit it? And
okay. Well, let's, Peter, what do you think?
Well, I don't know. It sounds a little strange. I mean, it's possible that one of his lodge brothers might have taken the ring. It's possible, certainly. They thought it shouldn't fall into a non-Mason's hands. And at the same time, I mean, I have friends who were Masons and or whose parents were Masons, and they still have some of their Masonic regalia from some very old traditional families, some Southern families that were very involved with Freemasonry. They still have some of the Masonic stuff with them. So if there was a tradition, it wasn't, you know, universal by any means. I don't know what to tell you, quite frankly. I don't know where the ring might have gone.
Also from Phoenix, Michael has got a wild card line on Coast to Coast. Michael?
Hi there. When you look at the presidential lineage of the Freemasons and the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commissions and all these various groups, do you feel that Barack Obama is involved?
Hey, Michael, you know what? Stop lying to get on the air. Stop making up names, different names in different places you're from, okay? I'm tired of this. Stop deceiving the call screener. Stop pretending you're different people, okay? We know it's you. We know you go by different names. Don't do this. It's just not, you know, it's not fair. So I understand you have an agenda, and you have a right to that agenda, but you don't have a right to keep dominating by lying to get on the air. We just don't appreciate that kind of deception. It's uncool, if nothing else. Peggy is in Wichita, Kansas on Coast to Coast AM. Peggy?
Yes, good morning. I'm originally from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Nice to have you.
Thank you, and I've been living in Wichita for the past 4.5 years.
We miss you.
Yeah, my book on Freemasonry just came out. I'm an African-American female whose father was in what they call Black Illuminati and committed suicide at 47 years old.
Oh, no.
Yeah, the book that I've written is called Freemasons, The Biblical Perspective, Why No Man Can Serve Two Masters, and you can get it on my website at drpeggyelliott.com. The questions that I have, thank you so much for all the research that you've done. Prince Hall Freemasonry and Order of the Eastern Star is what I've got in my book also, and I'm calling asking the author how much background information and research has he done on Prince Hall and the Order of the Eastern Stars?
Lots, okay. Peggy. So go ahead, Peter, real quick. You got about 30 seconds.
Okay, yes. In my book, I do cover Prince Hall Masonry. I feel that it was a brilliant and a courageous thing for Prince Hall to do, and that, you know, it's an affront to Freemasons that they haven't, you know, come to terms with this aspect of Freemasonry. It's only been recently that they've begun to recognize Prince Hall Masonry. But with only 30 seconds, that's all I can say.
Well, and I'll add this, though, and as I'm walking the clock up to the top, that you write extensively about it in the book. And Peggy, I think you would find it informative to see how it fits into the panoply of Masonry. Sorry about your father's suicide. Let's get back to the last half hour, though, of questions and comments. And I haven't forgotten the thing I want to return to next with Peter Levenda. If I can sneak in one more question on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. East of the Rockies, Bob is in Mansfield, Ohio on Coast to Coast AM for Peter Levenda, the Secret Temple. Bob?
Good morning. I think it's important to note that any large group of human beings are naturally inept. And if a cartoon on the newspaper would be a laughing matter tomorrow, they should be able to chuckle at it. They shouldn't have to have a secret society to defend their ineptness. The only way you can have large groups of people operating in a humane manner without attacking the human dignity and nobility, such as with their initiations, is with transparency. With all the technical things that are wrong with the world today, we are entrenched in a horrible recession bordering on depression that arrived out of multiple forms of secrecy. And I think both in our present government and in the future, I want nothing to do with any secret organization unless they're defending themselves from some horribly evil thing like the Nazis or the like.
Then don't join them, right?
I don't want them in my neighborhood. I don't associate with them personally. I think it's a crime that somebody as great as Truman had to be a 32-degree Mason to be a senator.
Well, I don't I don't know that he had to be one in order to become a senator, but, you know, I think this is the country's big enough to allow people to congregate freely. It's part of our constitution, right? And if it's a peaceable assembly, Bob, why do you want to stop them from assembling peaceably? And whether it's a women's book club or, you know, a yoga group, if they want to have secrets, doesn't bother me. But what about the idea that about politicians, though? I do think that is an intriguing aspect of your book, Peter, about the number of prominent politicians that came through skull and bones. That's really compelling.
Well, that's one of the things that should bother people, I think, more than talk about the Freemasons. Skull and Bones is, to me, a troubling organization, if only because they only bring in a very fixed number of people every year. I think it's 16 is the maximum number that they can initiate into Skull and Bones per year.
I think now, you said 15 in the book, but I'm
15,
just...
It could be 15. I forget offhand, but 15 or 16, but a very limited number, obviously, in the whole country. That's it. And if you count up all the people who could have been initiated into Skull and Bones over the last 100 years, you don't get very many. And yet, in the election, before this past election, we had George W. Bush and John Kerry both running for president against each other from different opposing parties, and yet both have been members of Skull and Bones. I mean, think of the astronomical numbers that we're talking about. We're talking about maybe a total of 1,600 people in the entire country, if they were all alive, had been initiated into Skull and Bones in the last 100 years, if they were all still alive and all politicians. And of that 1,600, out of 300 million Americans, two of those people were running for president.
Yeah.
I mean, the indication, it's breathtaking. And at the same time, neither one would discuss Skull and Bones with Tim Russert, for instance, of Meet the Press. I mean, can we have a president of the United States who's a member of a society that's so secret he can't even discuss it, even during a campaign? You know,
that I agree with. Totally.
That bothers me. Okay, that really does bother me. So, yeah, Skull and Bones I have issues with. I think what the caller is talking about is something that I'm always struggling with. The combination or the fight between secrecy on the one hand and privacy on the other. You know, when does privacy become secrecy?
Well, and I think a lot of the Masons would say they don't have any secrets anymore. They've been published. They've been republished. They're all over the Internet. We may not know which ones are the actual secrets and which ones are, you know, which ones have been written to create a camouflage for the real secrets. But, you know, I mean, I think that's part of it to me. I don't know. I just never feel threatened by the Freemasons. Now, I am curious in your research, which of the symbols on our money do you see as a direct link to Freemasonry? And I want to get back to that before too long, but Victor has been waiting in L.A. on Coast to Coast AM for Peter Lavenda. Victor?
Yes, good early morning, Ian and Peter. Hi.
Hi.
Yes, Ian, I sent you and Lex an email about an hour ago, and it depicts the 15 gentlemen of, I would say, the mystery group of the group we call Skull and Bones. There's many, like you said, there's many Skull and Bones elected every so many years. But this particular one, I actually have the original photograph of this particular group because it came from a building, Masonic building in the downtown area off Washington Boulevard. And it is structured, it has like four of those, I would say either four or six of those, no, six of those Washington Monument type structures, you know, the Washington Monument.
An obelisk is what you're referring to, an obelisk?
Yes, just structured right on the top of this building with the copper, tarnishing copper tops to them. And but there's something really mystical about the building, because I actually had an office in that building for about 3 years, and there's something mystical about that.
However, it's a Skull and Bones photo?
Because there's 15 gentlemen. They say it's Geronimo. Geronimo's skull sitting on the table. There's two gentlemen sitting down.
Right.
It's the clock behind the guy. The gentleman, 8 o'clock, set at 8 o'clock, and they're all dressed in suits, distinguished gentlemen. Looks like it's taken around the early 1900s, possibly. You know, just post-World War I, pre-World War II. And there's possibly that, I'm not sure, but George Harrison might be in that particular photograph to the far right. You get the email I attached.
You don't mean George Harrison of the Beatles, do you?
No, the okay. George Harrison, the one that, quote-unquote, ordered the attack on Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
Okay, just checking.
There's a possibility that could be him in that photograph. The other gentleman, one of them actually looks like Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's
well, why don't you send it to Peter Lavenda? Peter, do you want to see this photograph?
Yeah, it sounds interesting.
Yeah, well, either I'll send it to you or you can go ahead and send it to him, Ian, because I did direct it to your email. But go ahead, give me your email, and I'll send it to you.
Okay.
Do you want to give it on the air, Peter, or do you want me to put Victor on hold and you pass it along off the air?
I think I'll pass it along off the air.
Okay. Victor, hang on a second. I'm going to ask you to get on hold, and then Gina will get your email address, and we'll be able to hook you up with Peter that way. And my email box is insane these days. I actually have 3 email boxes, which are all overflowing, so that won't be the fastest way to get it to me. I'm sorry. Who's on the first-time caller line? It's not popping up on my screen. What's that?
It's Greg.
Hey, Greg. First-time caller line. You're talking with Peter Lavenda. Go ahead.
Hi, Ian. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
First of all, just let you know I'm a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a Mormon. I have 2 real quick yes or no questions and then just a couple comments of things that I've been taught that are similar to what he said. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. The first question is, Peter, have you ever read the Book of Mormon?
Yes.
Okay. Have you ever been in a Mormon temple?
No.
No. Okay. Just so everyone knows, before a Mormon temple is dedicated, anyone can go into the temple and go into the rooms where the ceremonies are taking place. They tell them what the ceremonies are, but they don't tell them the rites that go through. The caller earlier said about people coming over from Israel and going into the Americas. The Book of Mormon is that journey from Israel over to the Americas. I was taught that the seer stone that Joseph Smith, he received the seer stone from the angel Moroni, not that he used the seer stone to contact him. And I think the only other one was when he was talking about the garment or the Mormon underwear. It's not based on the apron. There is something in the temple garments. It is based on the apron, but the garments that you wear every day is not based on an apron.
Okay, Peter?
What the caller is talking about is the traditional Mormon doctrine on these issues. Of course, the caller believes that the Book of Mormon is the account of the lost tribes coming to the Americas. He's entitled naturally to that belief. I mean, that's what Joseph Smith said. As far as the seer stone is concerned, I have to take exception to the fact that the seer stone was received from the angel Moroni, but if only because the other evidence shows that Joseph Smith was using seer stones long before this confrontation with the angels, because he was using it to find treasure. He was involved in treasure seeking for years as a very young man before the Mormon phenomenon began. To put it one way, so I think. He had seer stones. Seer stones were commonly in use in that part of the world, in upstate New York and in other parts of New England, for contacting spirits. It's something that goes back to, you know, John Dee in England with his seer stone. It was something that's been used for thousands of years. It's an ancient technique.
And the apron as the origin for the undergarment traditionally worn by Church of Latter-day Saint members.
Well, some of the members of the church have expressed to me that it's the Mormon apron, and the ones that I've seen look suspiciously like the Mormon apron, if only because it's worn like an apron. It's white. It's in the same position. It's worn kind of identical to the Mormon apron. However, there is a possibility that we're also looking at something which comes down from the Jewish tradition of the shawl that they wear around the men wear around their waist also.
Tzitzit, right. Let's go to Paul in Texas on Coast to Coast AM. Paul? We're trying to get as many as we can in before the top of the hour, but before we want to leave a minute or two for the discussion of the symbols on money, too. Hey, Paul?
Yeah.
Okay, here's your chance. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, my question is about the Skull and Bone fraternity in relationship to Freemasons. Both are secret societies and both have secret ceremonies, and obviously both have powerful members. Do you think there's a link or is there a relationship between the CIA, the Skull and Bone, Freemasons, and UFO research?
Wow. Okay. As far as the link between Skull and Bones and the CIA, we've had, especially under the Bush administration, we had a lot of former Skull and Bones members. I don't know how former they can be considered, in positions in the National Intelligence Network, running CIA or running the Homeland Security, being in positions of intelligence czars. So, a connection between CIA and Skull and Bones is there. CIA recruited from Yale, famously. Where Skull and Bones is located. So there was a lot of crossover between Skull and Bones and CIA. The UFO research, that's above my pay grade, I think.
But it is an interesting connection on the Skull and Bones and intelligence, and that part shouldn't come as a shock, especially, though, again, that brings us back to the work of Dan Brown, who is often tying in Freemasonry and the sculpture that's in front of the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, which is a part of what his new book is going to be about, too. Hey, while I have you here, then, we're talking about those kind of symbols, and we'll get to as many colors as we can still, but on the back of a dollar bill, we have the unfinished pyramid. And that's sort of undisputably Masonic, isn't it?
From my point of view, yes. I mean, Masons have tried to poo-poo this connection, but the all-seeing eye is a famous Masonic symbol. The unfinished pyramid is a metaphor for the Masonic initiation. I mean, a Mason who's coming into Freemasonry is referred to as a rough stone that must be hewn, an ashlar, that must be carved and made into a dressed stone that can be used for building. I mean, a Freemason is a building in the act of being built, an unfinished building. So I think these are Masonic symbols from my point of view. I would say the Masons who try to deny this are just being a little disingenuous or something.
All right. How about, the New World Order concept, the Latin phrases, the groupings of the talons, the olive branch, and the arrows, and the other things that we see on the back?
Well, I have a tendency to agree with Freemasons, but that's not necessarily that Masonic. I mean, the eagle is not necessarily a Masonic symbol. The 13 arrows and the 13 olive branches refers, of course, to the 13 colonies. It's not a satanic reference, I'm fairly certain. The same with the stars and the shield over it. So I kind of don't see that necessarily as Masonic.
How about the Star of David symbol of the shield over the eagle?
Yeah, you could make a case. I mean, of course, it's Jewish also, but the Freemasons do use the six-pointed star, but they also use the five-pointed star as well, depending upon the design of the temple and other things, other symbolism. So when you're using symbols that are that basic, it could be almost anything, As long as it's not a swastika, I'm happy,
All right. Let's go to Jeff in Calgary on Coast to Coast AM for Peter Lavenda. Jeff?
Hi, great talk to both of you. Ian, you're my rock star favorite host of Coast to Coast.
Well, thank you. We're just glad to have you. Thank you.
I got introduced to Peter through a previous show, which I think you hosted, on Unholy Alliance. And fantastic book.
Thank you.
One of the things that I've picked up from what I think I'm reading from Peter is that occultism and secret societies, or being a member of a secret society, is not in and of itself evil. I mean, there's groups that used it for evil, most certainly. But when we take a look at today's society, I think most of the Masons and Freemasons are doing good, and that there was a time for secret societies when the church and the king would kill you if you messed with what they had going on.
Okay.
Is that right? And then I said, just had one question about your books. Well, I'm really looking forward to reading this one.
Good.
Should I?
We're just running out of time here, Jeff, so I just want to go ahead and get to – do we have time to answer that question about that? So go ahead, Peter.
I agree with your caller and from the point of view that I don't believe that secret societies are necessarily inherently evil. I don't believe occultism is inherently evil. I think that these are repositories of genuine information that's been suppressed or that's been ignored or rejected at various points in our history and which needs to be reinvestigated and reexamined. So I agree from that point of view. The secret societies do probably have a place even today, maybe even more so today than before. Maybe with all of the privacy invasions by government and by individuals and hacking of, you know, your email accounts or breaking into financial records. Maybe we have to go back to, you know, something that's off the grid and more secret and more private anyway.
Here I thought it was the Masons that were hacking my email. So
it's the Masonic conspiracy doing it.
Gerald in Arkansas on Coast to Coast. Last question. Got to be quick. Gerald.
Hey, Peter, Admiral John Paul Jones, he was the head of our Navy at the end of the Colonial War.
Yep.
He went, the Russian Tsar asked him to come to Russia, and he went over there and he demanded that, he had two demands. One that they...
We got to be quick here, Gerald. I said we're really coming up on the end of the show.
And charge one penny for every pencil in the country. Is there any...
I haven't heard this. I couldn't talk to it. I really don't know.
Okay. Well, that surprises me too. In light of all that you do get to in the Secret Temple, Masons, Mysteries, and the Founding of America, Peter Lavenda. Thank you so much. It was always a great show.
I appreciate it very much. You can get the book, of course, at Barnes and Noble and places like that, just to let people know.
And of course, you can link up to Peter through coasttocoastam.com. Thank you so much. Looking forward to whatever you come up with next, and we'll have you back on Coast to Coast. Thank you, Peter. And thank you, everybody, for great questions. Deus te amat, and I do, too.